We've been working through seven words for Lent here, which has been running through the seven things that Jesus said from the cross. So it's kind of seven things that he said while he was there. And just running through each one as we've gone through, which is what these posters at the sides are about and all the rest. And tonight, we're on to the final one. But if you've kind of missed the previous six, then there's... So we're going to do a little bit of just going over where we've been to bring us to where we currently are. So we're going to do a little bit of that. But I want to start off by just reading the story of the crucifixion in Luke. If you want to join me in Pew Bibles or whatever, it's Luke 23 that we're in, and it's starting at verse 32, actually. It says this, "Two other men, both criminals, were also led out with him to be executed. When they came to the place called the Skull, they crucified him there, along with the criminals, one on his right and the other on his left. Jesus said, 'Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they're doing.' And they divided up his clothes by casting lots. The people stood watching, and the rulers even sneered at him. They said, 'He saved others, let him save himself if he is God's Messiah, the chosen one.' The soldiers also came up and mocked him. They offered him wine vinegar and said, 'If you're the king of the Jews, save yourself.' There was a written notice above him which read, 'This is the king of the Jews.' One of the criminals who hung there hurled insults at him, 'Aren't you the Messiah? Save yourself and us.' But the other criminal rebuked him. 'Don't you fear God?' he said. 'Since you're under the same sentence, we're punished justly, for we're getting what our deeds deserve. But this man has done nothing wrong.' And then he said, 'Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom.' And Jesus answered him, 'Truly I tell you, today you'll be with me in paradise.' It was now about noon, and darkness came over the whole land until 3 p.m, for the sun stopped shining, and the curtain of the temple was torn in two. Jesus called out with a loud voice, 'Father, into your hands I commit my spirit.' And when he'd said this, he breathed his last." That last sentence is the one that we're on. So that's our seventh word. So it's this deal of, then Jesus shouted, "Father, I entrust my spirit into your hands." And with that, he breathed his last. And that's where we're going to be going today. But just to do a review of where we have been, because we've been a number of places with this, running through the words, and just to fill you guys in. And also do a review, because I'm not going to lie, I'm prepping this. I found it really helpful just to go over them, actually, because we've been to a lot of places. So we started off with our word number one, which was the word of forgiveness. And the word of forgiveness that Jesus came out with, "So Father, forgive them, for they know not what they're doing." And when we're talking, it's this aspect, isn't it, of Jesus on the cross. And I think sometimes it's easy for us to think that Jesus said these things under no pressure. I don't know if you guys are like me in that, but my brain often goes there. You know, when you start to hear these phrases, or you start to hear the words that Jesus has said, it's easy to think about them in sort of an isolated incident from the cross, right? That Jesus would say, "Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing." That sounds like the kind of thing Jesus would say. But to think doing that under the pain and the scrutiny of the cross, doing that and saying those words while you're under that immense level of pain and suffering, is quite a statement to make. And we were talking about, actually, Jesus chooses to forgive when he is at the ultimate level of punishment himself, the ultimate level of pain himself, the ultimate level of suffering himself. He chooses to forgive even then. And in that example of love, actually, what does that mean for us in our lives? If God forgives us in that sort of place, and actually how we treat others and forgive others. So that was our word number one. And I went on, had a look at word number two. Thank you, Mark, for the snazzy PowerPoint. There is no way I could do this. But here it is. So word number two that we looked at was the word of salvation. And it's, "Today you'll be with me in paradise," right? Which we read in the last passage in Luke. But this idea of Jesus saying on the cross to the criminal, "Today you'll be with me in paradise." That is, he says, "Remember me when you come into your kingdom." And if you guys were here for that week, Mark was chatting through that and saying, actually, what's the standard on entering the kingdom of God, right, was the question he asked. Remember, he asked us it as a congregation, and everybody got nervous, right? But it's like, what's the standard for getting into the kingdom? What's the thing? Like, you have to repent, right? You have to say the sinner's prayer, or you have to do something. There has to be a complete life turnaround. You need to behave a certain way. And actually, what did this criminal do? The thief on the cross, he just looked at Jesus and said, "Remember me when you come into your kingdom." And Jesus goes, "Great, that's enough. That's enough." And I think a lot of the time we have this perspective that for people to have a changed life, to come into the kingdom and be with Jesus, there needs to be this complete life transformation, right? I need to be perfect. I need to have made it. I need to be living that life. And actually, God's almost looking for reasons. And I think it's amazing how many people you come across in Christian faith that hold this view, that God's almost looking for reasons to tear us down, right? So it's like, you've been living really well, but you messed up there, and I'm going to point that one out. Whether I think actually God's much more on the other end of things, where he's looking for reasons to say yes, right? It's like this criminal and this thief's lived his life this way for so long that he even turns to the other guy and says, we're getting what we deserve. He's hanging on a cross and saying, I'm getting what I deserve. My deeds led me here, and I'm getting this, and fair enough. That's quite a place to be to make that statement. And he makes that statement about himself, and then just looks at Jesus and says, hey, remember me. And when he says that, Jesus is like, no worries, today you'll be with me in paradise. Jesus is just looking for that excuse. He loves his people so much that he's looking for a reason. He's like, give me something so I can say yes. You know, and there's this perspective I think we have on God where we almost look at him as Christians and think he's looking for an excuse to go, that's not okay, or you did that wrong. And actually, but God's looking for an excuse for people just to go, I love you so much, I love you so much, give me a reason to say yes, I love you so much. You know, it's this idea of a father who just adores his kids going, give me a reason, give me a reason, I want to bless you, give me a reason. Jesus, remember me, okay, I'll remember you, you're coming with me. Yeah, that's the kind of loving God we serve, that's awesome. And Jesus is making that statement from the cross, it's incredible. So jumping on to word number three, what have we got? This word of relationship. Even on the cross, Jesus is saying, here's your son, here's your mother, right? So to his mom and to the disciple he loved, he makes that statement. Quite an odd statement, but I think at the same time, it's that level of understanding of, do you know what? God is just about family, isn't he? Jesus is about putting us in community, in a family that look after each other, that love each other. If there's any place, if you're living life feeling isolated, that you should feel accepted, loved, and looked after, the church is it. Doesn't matter what walk of life you come from, what circumstances you come from, what your opinions that you hold are. You should feel welcome and loved in a place where people are honoring Jesus. Because he tells us we're to look after each other like that. But one of the big concerns he has is actually these people could be isolated when I die. I don't want that to be the case. Here's your son. Here's your mother. Go be family. Love each other. Make sure you care for each other. Don't be alone. And that actually brings us to that place of relationship. It's just brilliant. The love that even comes through in that thought, the consideration that's in there is just incredible for people and the care. So our next one that we dive to is the cry of desolation, where Jesus says on the cross, my God, why have you abandoned me? My God, why have you forsaken me? If you want to jump to the Hebrew, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, all that stuff, but just that idea of God, where are you? How can I not sense you? God, why have you forsaken me? And you know, the fascinating thing for me here is, and Mark looked at it on the week, but this concept of, is Jesus cut off from the Father at this point? And actually, theologically, no, he's not. But with the weight of the world and sin on his shoulders and carrying everything he is on the cross, there's that sense of distance where actually he can't feel the presence of God anymore. And I'm not going to lie, as a Christian, have you ever been there? When you've been at a point where you love God so much, he is your life, he's what you're dedicating your life to, but life has just sucked for a while. You know, there has been issue after issue, suffering after suffering, thing after thing that's just been bad, and you get to that point when you're just like, God, what is going on? What is going on? Where are you? You know, I'm praying, I'm not sensing anything, I'm calling for you, I'm not seeing anything, I'm trying to live the right life, nothing good seems to be happening. God, why have you forsaken me? Where are you? And actually, in saying that, what's he doing? He's quoting the Psalms. Jesus knew his scriptures. He knew how to be in pain. And I think for us as people, we sometimes think that when we're at that point, when we're at the end of ourselves, when life's really hard, it's like, can I be straight with God at that point? You know, can I turn around to God and be like, God, where are you? What are you doing? What's going on? Why is life so hard? And actually, Jesus on the cross gives us the perfect example. As God incarnate on the cross saying, God, where are you? Where are you? It's an incredible show of love and devotion to us to be at the point where he's willing to take on suffering to the extent where that relationship feels cut off to him. That's an insane commitment on God's behalf and the love that he shows for us, but it also shows us that in those moments it's okay to cry out. It's okay for us to be like, God, where are you? That's a perfectly okay place to be. And this cry of desolation that comes out. And then after that, we went on to the fifth word. So it's this idea of, I'm thirsty, right? The word of distress as he's there on the cross. And we looked at this word, but as we went into it and we dug a little deeper, we got to that point of saying, actually, in life, do we thirst for the things of God? And I think so often as Christians, it's weird, right? Because we're told all these things like we're in the world, but not of the world, right? That we're to be dedicated to the stuff of Jesus. But actually, it's really hard. It's really hard. I don't know if you guys have ever watched TV for 5 minutes, but the amount of adverts in there that would draw you away from things that Jesus would call you to do are insane, right? Everything that bombards us media-wise, pressure-wise, stress-wise, news, everything is just take your eyes off of that, right? Don't thirst for the stuff of God. Be concerned for this. Don't thirst for the stuff of God. Strive for stuff you don't need, right? It's really weird. I listened to a pastor a lot called Craig Rochelle. Love him. And he came out with this line that I loved where he was saying, if you want to drift from God at all, it's like spend your life working your tail off to earn money you don't need, to buy stuff you don't need, to impress people you don't like. Some statement, right? But it's true. You know, I kind of hear that statement and I sit and I laugh when it's said, and then after it's said, I laugh for 2 minutes and then I go, oh, I don't like that. You know, because there's that sense of I'm having a giggle at that and then I'm looking in the mirror thinking, oh, man. You know, and actually it's so easy, but we get into this pattern of life where it's like, I want to live this way, I want to achieve this, I want to have that car, that house, live there, be married to this person, be under this circumstance because it looks great. And then we work our way to get there to impress people we don't even like, and then we end up with a life we don't want. And it's incredible how often that happens. And there's this sort of deal of, do we thirst for the things of God? We're told that we all have living water inside us, right? Biblically, that Jesus is like a well, living water that springs up inside us. But I think for so many Christians, this, the well's gone stagnant, right? Just been at the point for a while where we've just been living. We've just been living. We've just been doing life. And actually, there's this point of, are you thirsting for the things of God? Get there. Get your heart back. That's on you, by the way. It's on you. Get your heart in the right place and be the kind of person that's going after Jesus. It makes a difference, right? And then this, finally, the word of triumph, it's finished, right? That Jesus on the cross gets that point of saying, it is finished. It's like, my work here is done, right? It's like you get to that point where it's, I have committed, I've stayed, I've seen the course, I've got to the end, it is finished. Death is beaten, sin is conquered, that's it. It's an incredible, incredible cry. And we talked a little bit in that week about how we often have this view of Jesus, I think, as a victim, right? I remember growing up for years as a Christian, I felt like poor Jesus at Easter, right? Like, poor Jesus. He did nothing wrong his entire life, and then he ended up on the cross. And that was so unfair that he ended up there. And then he went through all this suffering, and it's so bad. And then how did I feel on the back of that, right? If you've ever been through this thought process, you can join me at this point. You feel guilty, right? That's where it leads you. Because you get to that point of saying, Jesus went through all this because he loves me, and I suck so bad that he had to go through it all. That's the natural conclusion to draw off of that. So then you end up at that point of going, and because I suck so bad, he went through all that. So now I feel incredibly guilty but thankful at the same time. And then you read loads and loads of Bible verses that are like, when the sun sets you free indeed. There's no condemnation for those in Christ Jesus, and all this kind of stuff about you should be absolutely guilt-free and full of joy if you're a Christian. And then you hit Easter and you're like, but then why do I feel guilty about the fact he had to go to the cross? And then there's this idea that actually, and it is finished. Jesus wasn't a victim. It wasn't poor Jesus on the cross. He knew what he was doing. And I think for me, this was a massive theological switch in my head years ago, but it was awesome. It's when you hit that point of going, Jesus on the cross was a volunteer. He chose to be there. If he truly is who he says he is, he could have called down legions of angels at any time to get him off. He didn't have to stay. The people weren't in control of the situation. He was. And he chose to stay there because he values you that much. Then you don't feel guilty, you feel special. Okay, that leads you to a different place. I don't feel guilty, he didn't have to stay. I don't feel guilty, he didn't have to go through that. I feel ridiculously loved and special because he chose to, because he values me that much, he wanted our relationship back. That's why we celebrate Easter, right? Because God's love is so great that he chose to go through that and then get to the end of the journey and go, it is finished, it's done. I've bought it back, I've taken on the sin, I'm going to beat death, and people can come back to us, back to God. It's an incredible, incredible love story of willingness of Jesus, the volunteer, not the victim, and we had a look at that last week. And now, we've got word number seven. Dun, dun, dun. Exciting times. And actually, word number seven is this. It's the word of reunion. So Jesus hitting this point where it's, Father, I entrust my spirit into your hands. And trust my spirit into your hands. It's back to you. It's lovely, right? It's kind of this point for me where it's like, I've just gone through all of this. All these other words, I've just gone through it all. I'm teaching them, man, you got to forgive even in this circumstance. There's a way back to God no matter what you've done. And it doesn't have to be a complete life turnaround, everything on the table. It's just remember me. I'm looking for an excuse to say yes. On the back of that, this relationship, take care of each other, love each other like family. But actually, it's okay to cry out when life sucks. Because life does suck sometimes. And I think in church, we often have this expectation that if you turn up and you're broken, knackered, tired, and life's really hard, that you have to almost pretend it's okay while you're here. You know? And you hit that point when you look at the Bible and you look at Jesus and you look at his words and what he says, and you're like, where did we reach that conclusion? You know, when did middle class trump Jesus' words? It's really odd, right? But there's this deal of actually Jesus, he wants us to be straight with God, to cry out from where we are, to be honest, thirsting after the things of God. And then that celebration of it is finished, and then Jesus is like, right, I'm coming home. Father, into your hands I entrust my spirit. I'm coming home. My work here is done. It's a phenomenal place to be, and it's just this massive celebration as we come into Easter. So what are we looking at? I'm going to turn around to this screen because it's bigger. So Jesus, God incarnate, he chose the cross to show how trustworthy and loving God is. And this is the question I want to really hit you guys with today, right? I like doing questions and challenges. It's kind of like doing it. But what do you need to entrust into the Father's hands this Easter? You know, when Jesus hits that point of going, into your hands I commend my spirit, into your hands I entrust my spirit. For me, it's funny because I've got entrusting our spirit into God's hands. I think often that's the easy bit, you know? Saying to God, actually, I entrust my spirit into your hands, my salvation, my eternity, that's yours. Like, I'm good with that because I don't have any control over that, right? Handing something over I have no control over is incredibly easy. You know, I can't influence the outcome here at all apart from to say thank you. That's your bit. But then what's funny is, isn't the practical stuff harder? I don't know if you guys are like me on that. But I find it really easy to say to God, God, I entrust my spirit, my future, my eternity into your hands. That's good. I'm good with that. I entrust my finances to you and insurance companies and banks and other stuff. You know, and you get to that point where it's kind of like, I entrust the spiritual stuff. That's cool. That's yours. I'll do that. That's great, right? That's easy. And then actually you get to that practical stuff and it's like my finances, my time, my family that I love, my family that annoy me, the kids, the future, my job security, my work circumstances, my mortgage, all the stresses and pains of the world, all the media stuff, all the stuff we're talking about earlier and advertising, all of that depends on the day, right? Can depend on the hour. I entrust this into your hands. And the thing for me is that God calls us to this life where he promises us life in abundance, right? Life in all its fullness. He promises us if the sun sets you free, you're free indeed. He promises us so much stuff about this great, stress-free, guilt-free life where it's wonderful and we get life and just this incredible life that Jesus talks about, where we get to see miracles and freedom and all sorts of cool stuff that makes us go, yes! And then we can look at our own life and go, and where did that go? You know, you kind of go, there's been flashes and there's been phases, but, you know, where's that stuff? And I think a lot of the time it's because we're great at spiritualizing things in the church, right? Great at spiritualizing things. Life's really hard at the moment, and then we'll use some spiritual phrase to lift people up, right? And that's cool. Like, those phrases are great, and they can be really helpful at times. But the thing is, Jesus had hands and feet, and he was practical. He helped people. You know, he did stuff. He didn't just talk about stuff. You know, Jesus, his story would have been a lot weirder if there was people who were blind or crippled or deaf or whatever else, or mute, and Jesus was walking up to them, and he was like, what can I do for you? And they went, oh, this is my circumstance and situation, and Jesus went, great, I'll pray for you, and then he walked off and went home. Right? But actually, for the church, that's often how we look, because we get to that point where it's like we have faith to say that we'll pray later, but we're not really sure. You know, and we get to that point where we're on the practical stuff where the outcome depends on him, and it makes us nervous. It's tough. It's where the rubber hits the road, right? It really is. It's those moments where actually what we say we believe and what we really believe become very apparent. And I think for me, this idea of what do you entrust into Jesus' hands? What are your worries? What are your stresses? What are the things that hit you in life? What are the things that take your eyes off Jesus, right? We're just singing, turn your eyes upon Jesus. The thing is, that song's a wonderful song, but there'd be no point in singing, turn your eyes upon Jesus, if our eyes didn't go somewhere else at times, right? And I think for me, what are the things that take your eyes off of him? And how can you entrust them into God's hands? Because he's not just the God that Jesus conveys his spirit to. He's the God who looks after us. Who says, actually, look at the sparrows. They don't sow or reap or do anything like that. But God looks after them. You know, how much more will your Father in heaven look after you? Just seek after his kingdom and his righteousness, and all that stuff will be taken care of, right? Matthew 6. It's incredible, this sort of deal that God offers us. And here's the thing, knowing that Jesus forgives that way, but not just that he forgives, and I want you to get this, is even on the cross, you know? I kind of think that for me, I can find it easy to forgive people at times when my life's going well and I'm doing well and I can sense God's blessing and see God's blessing. Forgiving people then, aces. When life's really difficult, feels unfair, it's been really tough for a long time, I'm really struggling, and then actually you're at the lower end of yourself and not in a good place. Forgiving people then, different ballgame, right? It's a different ballgame. And I think for me, as Jesus, even on the cross, he forgives like that. Even on the cross, he offers salvation. Wow, it just blows my mind. Encourages family and care amongst his followers. Even on the cross, he does that. Actually, he teaches us how to lament. He teaches us how to get out the pain at the unfairness of the world and yet still be obedient to what God's calling him to do. Even on the cross, he does that. That he shows us how to thirst well, even on the cross. And he shows us how to be triumphantly obedient all the way to the finish line. And he does that even on the cross, under that level of pain, scrutiny, that level of suffering. He does it then. That's nuts to me. It absolutely blows my mind. And what's your response to that? You know, it's our response to that we go, Father, into your hands I entrust my spirit, but I'm still worried about this. You know, or do you get to that point when you're like, God, you know what? If that's the way you love, if that's the way you forgive, if that's the way you offer salvation, if that's the way you bring us family, if that's the way you look after us, if that's really who you are, then I can trust everything, right? And trust that God's going to take care of that because he's big enough and he's good enough. And I hope you're getting this, but he really, 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 really loves you. Like, really loves you. Like, I could stand here and use really for the next hour and then say loves you at the end. It still wouldn't be enough, right? That's how much he loves you. And under that circumstance, as a perfect father who takes care of you and adores you, what is it that you're holding on to that causes your life not to be what God would have it to be, that you need to let go of? That you need to say, God, into your hands, I give this. I give it. I don't want to hold on to it anymore. It's yours. I trust that you're enough. Where is it that you're at with that? The thing is, it's a challenge, right? And I want to be honest with this one, right? I think it's really easy to stand at the front and be like, just give it to God and it'll all be wonderful, right? And if it was that easy, then all our lives would be wonderful all the time, wouldn't they? And yet they're not. So it's at that kind of point where, do you know what? It is a challenge. It's not easy. And it's a constant decision, right? Just because you pray about it today, it doesn't mean it won't stress you out tomorrow. It might be that it goes away. It might be that it comes back. Miracles absolutely happen, but they don't happen every time. And the thing is, God is more concerned with shaping your character to be like him than making your life easy. And actually, a lot of the time, when God's shaping our character, we have to go through suffering for that to happen, you know? It's very easy to say that God provides for you. It's very hard to learn that God provides for you. You know, those two things are very different things. And actually, it doesn't take away the hurt. That's the other side. If you've got something that plays on your heart, when we're talking about this, what do you need to give over to God? And it could be bereavement, right? It could be people you've lost. It could be the end of a relationship. It could be the end of things you really, really cared about. And just saying hand it over to God isn't going to take the pain away. It might. I know of situations where people have prayed and it absolutely did. But I know of plenty where it didn't. And actually, it's the same God in both circumstances. So it's not easy, but it's a constant choice. It's a constant choice. But the thing is, when we persist in obedience to the call of God through our struggles, that's when we experience the life he has for us, right? When we go, it might be easier for me to pull out at this moment, but I'm going to keep going because I trust that God is good. I want to share a wee story, and we'll dive on from this bit. But me and Fee have been married almost 11 years now. I kind of like her. If you ever meet Fee, she's ace, by the way. She's really good. I think I'd go as far to say that she's my favorite woman I've ever met. You know, she's just great. And it's funny because in being married for 11 years, when you get started, and any of you guys who are early days in marriage or have been there, you know, once you get settled into a routine and you've had years and you've got kind of, you know, finances and bills and all that stuff into a routine, and it actually starts to make sense, and you're old enough and mature enough to figure out what all that means. Because for me, I'm not going to lie, we both got married at 20. And when we got married, Fee had actually had savings because Fee has an aspect of maturity about her character with money. I had no savings because I don't. And I think when we got married, all my savings were on the wall in a CD collection and all Fee's were in a bank. Turns out hers were more useful. And actually, when we got married, we ended up, God had called me at Bible college at that time through a number of different circumstances, and I'd started there. And the great thing about it is that when you first start as an apprentice, anything, right? Doesn't matter what it is, you're minimum wage, right? That's where you're going. You know, least we can pay you, you're one apprentice, go for it. Just prove that you're going to stick around, right? And actually, I remember because I got paid £320 a month, and we had a mortgage, and my university was in Glasgow. It was strange because Fee had her job, and she was working full-time. But by the time that we got married and we settled up on our bills and everything else, we were at the stage where our finances, basically every month, if we didn't spend anything, the amount we earned was here, and the amount that we had to spend on all our financial commitments that meant we could have a house and heating were here. They were basically the same. There was £15 difference before we'd bought any food or fuel, by the way. My university was in Glasgow. So we were in this situation where you're sort of looking at it going, this looks bad, you know? And I remember chatting to Fee at the time going, I don't know what we're going to do here, pal. You know, I was like, I'm thinking maybe dropout time. And I was like, we need to figure this out. We need to drop out or need to see what's going to happen. And then I committed and we went to uni for 2 months. And then after 2 months, they got in touch with us to say that because it was a private Bible college and it wasn't a sort of UCAS university, for want of a better phrase, that the fees were not covered by SAS. SAS would cover a proportion, but I owed the college £3,500 every year I was studying there, and I had to go there for 3 years. So you ended up at this point where you go, our bills to finances every month make no sense. I have to spend more on fuel. That means we're in debt every month. And that was using my student loan. And we now owe the university £10,500 that we don't have. Yay for us, right? And we started on that journey. And it was funny because at the end of Christmas year two, so it was when I was about, halfway through my degree, I just started getting letters in my pigeonhole, right? And if Lawrence ever listens to this sermon, I love you, Lawrence. He was the treasurer at ICC. He was brilliant. And he got to this point where instead of writing me letters, because I got big official letters for a long time that went, your fees were due a long time ago. We know your circumstances, but come on, man. You know, in other words. And he got to the point where instead of giving me that, he just put a post-it note in my pigeonhole every day, and it just had the word fees and a question mark after it, right? You got to the point where it's like, I'm not even wasting paper anymore. Just come on, man, are they there yet? And I remember getting to the stage where I was praying, and I was like, God, I don't know what's going on here, but we've committed to this, and I think we're doing the right thing. And that makes it sound like I was really calm and collected. I cried a lot, so did Fee. Life was really tough. Didn't know what God was doing in it. I was like, God, if you called us here, like, what is going on? I totally believe you did, but what is going on? You know, and it's that cry of desolation going, my God, to be trained in ministry, why am I financially screwed, you know? And it's that was the situation that we were at. And then the funny thing was that at the moment where I'd said to Fee one night, Fee, I think it's time for me to drop out. I think I'm going to need to leave. I think I'm at that stage where we can't actually keep it going anymore. And the uni are going to start pressing for the money and I can't pay. So I think we're going to need to leave. We got a call from somebody in this church, actually, who I didn't know. But had got our number because they'd been praying and said, God told us that we need to pay your university fees. And I just got a call on our house phone one night, and they phoned up, and I picked up the phone. And they were just like, hey, Ross. I was like, hey. And they were like, look, we wish to remain anonymous, which is why I'm now saying what I'm saying. But they also said, but we really feel like God's calling us to pay your university fees. We came into a bit of money. It's a good amount of money, and we want to pay your university fees off it. And I was like, okay. But you don't know how much they are, and you're probably assuming it's a few grand. It's 10,500. I know, like, that's a lot of money. And then their response to that was, oh, that's cool. The amount that we came into was 10,600. Great. And I appeared at university that Thursday, and the treasurer was just standing there, and he was like, oh, by the way, your fees have been paid for next year too. And you just walk into uni, and I was like, what? You know, and for me, and that idea of learning that God will provide, for me, those 3 years at university blew my mind. Because I was left at that stage where I was kind of like, God, I can't provide. I'm actually at that stage where I can't. Like, this is not something that I can do. But I want to persist and do what it is that I believe you're calling me to do, because I think I'm doing the right thing here. And we pray about it, and I think we're doing it. But you know, there was nights of tears, there was a lot of anger, there was a lot of frustration, there was a lot of, God, what on earth are you up to? There was all that kind of stuff, you know, and that's the clean version. And I think there was a ton of frustration, ton of anger. And you got to that stage where, for me, actually seeing God come through at the end of it changes it from being this idea of God says he will provide for your needs to being like, wow, God actually provides for your needs. And see, moving from that being a theory to that being a reality, one of the hardest journeys I've ever gone on. And I think it's the best. Loved it. Looking back, it's one of my favorite three-year periods of my life. And it's funny because I think for me, we often think that life to the full attributes to comfort, right? Life being easy. That'd be life in all its fullness, right? Just freedom to do what I want whenever I want. And I don't think that's what life to the full is. I think a life with challenge, where we see God come through, where we get to see faith become reality, where we get to see heaven invade earth, when we get to see God's goodness come into our lives today, that's life in all its fullness. That's what God calls us to. But actually, if we have all the means ourselves, then why do we need to trust him? And that's what I'm saying this morning. What is it that you need to trust God with so that he can be God in your life? So that he can take it, so that he can do a miracle that you couldn't do by yourself? So that you can see him come through, so that you can have that experience that takes faith from a theory to a reality. Because I promise you, it's the best thing you'll go through. At the time, just make sure you have good friends. But it is the best thing you can go through. The thing is, if Jesus says life in all its fullness, it's meant to be stress-free. I think it sounds a bit like that, you know, this idea of life in all its fullness. You kind of think there's not going to be a lot of stress involved, right? I'm not going to have to worry all the time. And you get these verses like, cast your cares onto him, cast your anxieties onto him because he cares for you, and all this kind of stuff. And for me, I love those verses. I absolutely love them. But for me, why would we need to cast our anxieties onto him unless we had reason to be anxious? Why would we need to cast our cares on him unless we had reasons to be worried? Why would we need to give our stress to Jesus unless life left us with reasons to feel stressed? You know, God knows that that's going to hit us in life, but he also knows that in those circumstances, he's enough. That by his Spirit, he can help us through it. He grows our character. He teaches us to love. He teaches us to persist. And we get to experience that love infiltrate our lives. So that at the worst situations in our life, we can go, God, into your hands I give my finances. I don't know what to do there, but I'm trying to honor you, but it's yours. Just take it. I don't want to live stressed with that. God, into your hands I give that relationship. I struggle like crazy with it, but help me. God, into your hands I give my worries, into your hands I give my concerns, into your hands I give my family that wind me up and make my life really difficult, into your hands I give my kids who I'm trying to teach about faith, but they just seem to be going the wrong way, into your hands I give everything that is concerning me that stops me drawing closer to you. I pass it over because I want to live free from the shame, free from the guilt, in a loving relationship with a Father who adores me. And that's what we're called to, Easter. That's what Jesus won on the cross. That's what was won on the cross, was life for us and life the way God wants it to be. That was what was won. And when Jesus says, into your hands I commend my Spirit, it's him going, I'm coming home so we can send the Holy Spirit so that they can have that life. That's what happened. And actually, in the availability of that life, I think so often God's going, this is what there is for you. And we accept this because that's normal, right? I told a wee story and it is finished. And I want to finish on this story. Eden's our eldest. She's 5. She's wonderful. If you ever meet Eden, you'll know because she'll chat to you for a half hour. She really likes to talk, and she's really, really wonderful. I like her a lot. And when we were on holiday one time, we went away, and there was a swimming pool at the place we were staying, but the pool was dead cold, and I mean like ice, right? You walked outside into the pool and stepped in it, and you stepped out very quickly. Eden was more committed than me and Fee. We never really went in it at all. She really enjoyed the pool, but she never stayed in it for long periods of time, and she came out with blue lips, which as parents is relatively concerning. And I think she was at that kind of stage. And as she was coming out one time, I'd been chatting to Fee, and I was like, Fee, the beach is like a 10-minute bus ride away. The water's going to be warmer than this. We can go have fun, right? Let's do it this afternoon. Let's go to the beach, right? We told Eden, and we're like, Eden, we're going to the beach this afternoon, right? And then Eden being Eden, because if you know her, she is extremely determined, turns around, and she's like, no, I like the pool, right? Is Eden's response, no, I like the pool. And I was kind of like, okay. And then we did the kind of nice parent thing of trying to reason with her for a while, and being like, right, Eden, we're not going to stay at the pool. We're going to go to the beach, but when we get there, we'll buy you ice cream. So, you know, it'll be good, right? To which Eden's response was, thank you, but I'm staying at the pool, right? And then after about an hour of trying to negotiate with her over lunch, I eventually got to the point where I was like, right, Eden, here's what's happening, right? Dad got grumpy. Okay, here's what's happening. Daddy's going to pick you up and carry you to the bus. We're going to the beach and you're going to be happy. We're on holiday, right? Yeah, absolutely. We're going to enjoy today. Even if you're crying, we're going, right? And then we arrived at the beach. And the funny thing was that after arriving at the beach, she had a blast. She had a great time at the beach. And we never went back to the pool for the rest of the week and a half we were there, right? The beach was so much better. She loved it. And I think for me in our Christian life, that's where we end up. Because we hold on to our concerns and worries. We live at the pool, you know? We live at the pool with this Christian life that just isn't what God had it to be. It isn't what he promised. It isn't what he's offering us. It's a proportion of it. There's water there. You know, it's a little bit, and there's a bit of life there, and it's a bit of fun, but it's still hard, and we don't see it, and we don't get to be released, and we don't get the fun or the enjoyment that we could have. But we've got enough that we're like, God, my life is yours, but I'm going to live with all my concerns and all my worries and all my woes and all the struggles, and I'm going to keep all them, but I'm going to live at the pool because it's still nice, and I'm still in living water to a degree. And I think for us, a lot of the time, God's like, but the beach is there. You know, it's like he's going, the sea is there. You can live free from that. Pass all that stuff to me and go and have life. Go and do it. And we go, that is a great idea, God. I really like that idea. So into your hands, I entrust my spirit. That's great. So that's the pool, and I'm going to stay here, right? And then we kind of stay with a second-rate Christian life because we're so concerned about passing the stuff over that we want to hold on to because we're worried about it. And for me, I want to say this Easter, give it over. God has freedom for you. He has life where in the midst of struggles you can smile, where you can really say to him, God, into your hands I give this. I don't want to carry it anymore. It's yours. Take it. I want to have the life you promise. Because the thing is, God doesn't lie. And I think a lot of the time as Christians, we live like he does, which is quite an accusation to make, so let me back it up. But God says that we can have life in all its fullness and cast your cares on him and anxieties on him because he cares for you. His yoke is easy and his burden is light, right? And then we live as Christians like the yoke is very heavy and the burden is hard. And we're left going, actually, so either Jesus lied or there's something we could change. I know it's a difficult statement, but it's true, right? Either he lied saying his yoke is easy and his burden's light, or there's something we could change in the way we're living. And for me, it's when we cast our cares and anxieties on him and we choose to do that continually that we get to live light and that we get to live free. That's a choice on our part. We can stay at the pillar, we can go to the beach. And that's what I want to leave you guys with today.